לתשומת ליבכם, התוכנית הבאה היא תוכנית מוקלטת, ועשויות להישמע במהלכה התראות והתייחסות לאירועים ביטחוניים שיראו בזמן שידורה הראשון. האזנה טובה.
You're listening to the English language news of Kan, the Israeli Public Broadcasting Corporation.
Good evening, Mo'adim L'Simcha and Shavua Tov. Welcome to our Saturday night program recapping the top news stories we covered this week. I'm Aryeh O'Sullivan. This week saw Passover celebrations amid the ongoing war with Hamas and Hezbollah on the northern border and the surging pro-Palestinian demonstrations on U.S. campuses. We examined that, as well as the U.S. sanctions on a largely religious IDF combat battalion and other news. Let's get started. Families gathered around the Seder table this week, many missing those who were not with us. The October 7th attack, the hostages still in captivity, the ongoing war, and those still displaced from their homes have deeply affected the spirit of the holiday. Rabbi Dalia Marks, the Aaron D. Pankin Professor of Liturgy and Midrash at Hebrew Union College and author of From Time to Time, Journeys in the Jewish Calendar, spoke to our reporter Naomi Segal about Passover in this challenging time and how we can impart special meaning to the Seder.
I think this year is going to be quite challenging to think about Pesach, which is the celebration of Chirut, of freedom, of liberation. How can we think about liberation in times like this? Well, we recorded a few days before Passover, so let us hope that by the time it is broadcast, all the hostages will be home and we could talk about this whole situation in past tense. But nevertheless, we experienced this year an unprecedented, difficult, scary, challenging time on so many levels. And we experienced it also in the previous festivals, right? If Hanukkah is, among other things, the festival of heroism, of victory. We were not completely there when we celebrated. This Purim is a celebration of joy and merriment. And that was also challenging. And the same with the Passover. And I think in and of itself, this is the unique feature, the unique nature of Jewish festivals, maybe all festivals, not just Jewish, the unique junction between the circular time, the festivals will always come back, and the linear time that is not repeating itself. Well, let's hope it's not repeating itself. The historical time that every moment is new or different. So the junction between these two types of time, the repetitive time and the one time, the linear, unique time, is what gives our celebrations the unique feature. Yeah? If I think about Pesach, this is actually a very good example. The initial celebration of Pesach was to offer the sacrificial lamb in the temple. And when that was not possible anymore due to the destruction of the temple, and let us say that I have no yearning for the reconstruction or the rebuild of the temple and the restoration of the sacrificial cult, but when this was not longer possible, the rabbis replaced the offering, the actual offering in the temple, with a celebration of text. That's the birth of the Seder in its initial form by the sages of the Mishnah and later on. And when Jews suffered the persecution, and remember, Passover was the most dangerous time in the year for Jews under Christianity. That's the time in the year where most blood libels were committed against the Jews. You know, that the Jews are using blood of Christian children to produce their matzahs and things like this, and Jews killed Jesus, etc. This was the time of the gravest persecutions. Jews were very much afraid, and that explains the birth of the messianic part of the Haggadah, the piyutim, the liturgical hymns that you find at the end of the Passover Haggadah, the Passover text. that talk about the redemption, about the messianic age, about the coming of the Messiah, right? That's an innovation that was added to the Haggadah in times of distress. And the same this year, I see around me countless of suggestions and new texts, the new rituals to add, that people propose to add into our Passover Haggadah to mark the special situation, the special tragic and sad situation that we're in, and to give it a meaning in the framework of the Passover celebration.
So if, as you say, over the generations and years, especially here with Passover, it unfolds the tribulations and the events mm-hmm. that the Jewish people have found themselves in, and certainly the Passover Seder traditionally is a time about questions and discussion, right. And perhaps plumbing those texts to also find insights and strengths. What are some that you might tap into at this time?
Right, it's exactly at the core, at the base, at the heart of the Passover celebration is the question. And the question is, Manishtana, what is different this year? How is it different? What has changed? And it encourages us to reflect and to meditate and to think about our own lives as individuals, as families, as a nation. Also, I would say, in a global way, how our world is changed. And I think this year you can see all kinds of suggestions to mark this Manishtana, what is different. So I can think of a few things. The suggestions that I would like to share with you today are taken from the Reform Movement, Israeli Reform Movement website. So one suggestion is to decorate the table with yellow ribbons, which became a symbol for the commitment and the yearning and the struggle to return the hostages. That's in Israel. Interestingly enough, in the States, I saw they're using normally blue ribbon for some reason, but we're using yellow ribbon, which I think is an American thing initially. So today, that should be part of the decoration that informs the situation that we are now. Another proposal is to have a special cup, right? In Passover, we have four cups of wine, and then we have a cup of Eliyahu, of Elijah. And in many families, you have an additional cup. That's the cup of Miriam that has living water in it, not wine. But this year, there's a proposal to incorporate in on the table a cup that is half full, that symbolizes our hopes and yearnings, that we can fill it to its fullness by next year, because our lives are not full, or we're not complete until the hostages return home. That's another suggestion. In many families, and I also saw it in many synagogues, you leave an empty chair to mark the feeling that we cannot really be together, or we cannot really be around the table without the missing presence of those who need to be with us, and they are not with us anymore. There's been a beautiful text by Rabbi Alona Lisitsa that is to be recited when we cut the matzah, the unleavened bread, into two halves. And by this text, we mark the sadness and the mourning about the fact that half of our heart is captive in Gaza, with all these people who are in the tunnels, and we don't know who of them is alive and how are they, and we really miss them, and we want them to come back home. And again, there are all kinds of texts that were proposed. There are additional four questions. There is an additional 10 plagues, and also a suggestion to drip a drop of the wine into, like we do when we read the traditional 10 plagues. So you can see that we use symbols of the traditional Passover celebration and commemoration in order to bring attention to the current situation where we're at right now. Well, and I will just add to this, that Passover, more than other celebration, is the place where we talk about our peoplehood, the state where we are, this is the time where in a lot of families, the older people in the family, the older generation, tell about their experiences in the young state of Israel, in the Holocaust, the sojournings and migration. This is a time where you have intergenerational discourse, and this time it's all generations together experience this terrible events of October 7th and everything that followed it.
Certainly, many of the questions that come up during Passover, and first and foremost, how does this relate to me, are especially applicable in these days, that we feel very connected to these questions more than ever, perhaps.
Absolutely. And I will add to that, as we said at the beginning, that time of distress and time of trouble and times that we experience catastrophe is a great catalyst for liturgical and ritual innovations. That's what we see often. But the other side of this coin is that creativity, liturgical, religious, textual creativity is a coping device with our reality and the difficulties that we experience. We use it to explain to ourselves what we're experiencing and what we are hoping for, what we are praying for, how we envision our lives after this distress, and what we should do in order to get out of this situation.
Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much, Naomi. Toda rabba, and may it indeed be Chag Sameach. Happy Passover.
Rabbi Dalia Marks, Aaron D. Penkin, Professor of Liturgy and Midrash at Hebrew Union College, and author from Time to Time, Journeys in Our Jewish Calendar. Pro-Palestinian demonstrations and anti-Semitism on U.S. campuses. Opposition leader Yair Lapid has urged the Biden administration to take action as pro-Palestinian demonstrations spread to more American university campuses. Some of the protests have included calls for violence and alleged harassment of Jewish students. On many of the campuses, protesters have set up unauthorized encampments of tents to press their demands, most notably at the Columbia University in New York City. What's happening on American colleges' campuses is unforgivable, Lapid said. It is anti-Semitism. It is support for terrorism. The administration cannot stand by. It has to intervene. The White House said this week that it was monitoring the situation on college campuses closely, saying people have the right to publicly protest, but not physical intimidation or calls for violence, citing some alarming rhetoric. Our reporter Mark Weiss spoke with Lahav Harko from the Misgav Institute for National Security and Zionist Strategy.
First of all, if you can bring our listeners up to date with what exactly is happening on campuses in America.
So, you know, there's many thousands of college campuses across the United States, and a large number of them, especially the ones that are sort of considered elite campuses, are having massive anti-Israel demonstration movements, tent camps and things like that, that have been, for months now really, harassing and threatening and in a few cases actually executing violence against Jewish students. They claim Zionist students, but it's basically all the Jewish students and sometimes faculty on campus. And in the last weekend, what's gotten a lot of attention is Columbia University in Manhattan on the Upper West Side, where there's really, large numbers of these tents, which, by the way, does not look like people spontaneously took out their camping gear. They're all the same kind of tent, which, I don't have the answer to who and when bought them those tents, but it looks very organized. And they're blocking what they call, quote unquote, Zionist students from entering campus. They're saying threatening things. They're saying go back to Poland. They're saying burn down Tel Aviv. They've been calling for the elimination of Israel for, more than 6 months now. And the leadership, the college president, has started bringing in police to clear out the protests because they've been so disruptive. And in the meantime, she's also shut down in-person classes. So classes are going to be virtual, which is many are viewing sort of as a surrender to the protests, that they've sort of successfully taken over the campus if it's been so disruptive that you can't hold class.
How much of this is legitimate protest and how much of this is anti-Semitism?
Look, I think everyone, who's familiar with the environment on campus knew that there were going to be pro-Palestinian protests on campus. And I think it's legitimate. Nobody, we could all have different opinions and we can all see this war differently. But when it crosses the threshold into threats and harassment of students, that's when it's no longer legitimate. And frankly, I think in many cases, these campus protests cross that threshold very early on, within the first few weeks of the war, but nobody paid attention until it became so big and such a major disruption that it was affecting everyone.
So would you say it's already at the stage that on many campuses, Jewish students are afraid to go to classes?
Yeah, or afraid to cross certain parts of campus, afraid to go to their dorms even. I mean, it's again, it varies from campus to campus, but certainly in the places where these things have gotten out of control, you hear from a lot of students, whether it's the younger students who are 18, 19 years old, or even graduate students who could be, you know, 10 years older than that, that they are afraid of the atmosphere in campus. They are afraid that there will be actual violence against them.
Do we know of any specific groups that are behind these protests and who might be funding them?
So a lot of this comes from Students for Justice in Palestine, which is an organization that's on colleges across the United States, has connections to Palestinian groups that were outlawed because of their connections to Hamas, and also was founded with funding from Qatar. That being said, I don't think I've seen reports specifically on these protests. But it's that organization, Students for Justice in Palestine, which has long had a lot of very suspicious funding, I would say.
Yesterday, we heard comments from President Biden when he was asked about anti-Semitism. He said while he condemns anti-Semitism, he also condemns what he called people who don't really understand what's going on in Palestine. This wasn't really the clear-cut condemnation of anti-Semitism that many people were hoping for, was it?
Yeah, and you know, I think it's sort of a continuation of what his attitude has been on Israel for a long time now, for several months now, which is, you know, they continue the aid to Israel, for which, you know, Israelis are very grateful, and it is very important to Israel. But they're, every time Biden is asked about Israel, he has something critical to say, you know, and to me, that's not leadership. You need to, you know, you take a stand, then you need to stand up for it. You need to show moral clarity. And in this case, he's not showing moral clarity about a domestic anti-Semitism problem, right? The fact that he's conflating anti-Semitism with understanding the plight of Palestinians is completely unacceptable and frankly immoral, right? It's, if somebody doesn't understand something that's happening 6,000 miles away from America, they deserve to be victims of racist harassments and threats in America. And this is, you know, what you're seeing from the college campus presidents as well. It's as if there is no actual word called anti-Semitism. It's this long compound word called anti-Semitism and Islamophobia. I'm not saying you don't have to address Islamophobia. If there's a problem, you should address it. But anti-Semitism should be tackled, you know, head on. And if it has to be combined with all these other sort of mealy-mouthed, you know, hedges, then that's not going to work. And that's the reason why, despite this problem being around for 6 months and college presidents being aware of it, remember that hearing in Congress that ended up with the resignation of the president of Harvard, that was in December already, right? But the reason that these protests kept going, I think, is because nobody was willing to call them what they are and stand up for Jews, qua Jews.
Yesterday, we saw reports that some of the major Jewish funders were withdrawing their funding from Columbia. We saw that earlier as well with Harvard, etc. Do you think this is the best way to pressure the university administrations to act more firmly?
I think it's one very good way. But I think that you have to sort of keep the pressure on, because you saw people doing that in Harvard very soon after October 7th. And then they formed a committee to fight anti-Semitism. And then people who genuinely cared about the well-being of Jews on campus soon quit that committee because they felt that it was just window dressing. You know, unless there's real and consistent pressure on these campuses, it can be from funders, it can be from Congress. It just looks like they're not that incentivized to fight the anti-Semitism.
Finally, I presume these protests will continue as long as the war in Gaza continues.
And, you know, it's fine to have protests, right? It's just that these protests have crossed the line that they have been threatening and harassing to fellow students and faculty. I wouldn't expect protests of any form, you know, of the regular peaceful form to end, because opinions differ, right? But this is more than protests.
Lav Harko from the Mizgav Institute for National Security and Zionist Strategy. And now here's Yishai Ribo and his song Halev Sheli, My Heart.
Halev Sheli nikra leshnayim Ma shelo ata shifcha lamayim Kmo sufa min hayam olem Kmo tofa shel Miriam poem Ven trufa baolam Halev Sheli merim yadayim כבר מועד לא עומד על הרגליים שבר כלי שאין בו כבר מה והשמיים הם לי חומה חבור בתוך הים ביבשה ורק אתה יכול להפוך מספדי למחול לזכך את החול לרקח בי הכל לגשת ללב שלי משכך כל כאב שבי מרפא את הלב הלב שלי נקרא לשניים חציו השם וחציו לשם שמיים כמו סופה מן הים עולם כמו תופעה של מרים פועם ואין תרופה בעולם ללב ורק אתה יכול להפוך מספדי למחול לזכך את החול לרקח בי הכל ורק אתה מבין איך לגשת ללב שלי משכך כל כאב שבי מרפא את הלב צר שמציק לצון ואין ציר שיצק לצור רק אני מול ים שלם ולב שבור ורק אתה יכול להפוך מספדי למחול לזכך את החול לרקח בי הכל לגשת ללב שלי משכך כל כאב שבי מרפא את הלב ורק אתה יכול להפוך מספדי למחול לזכך את החול לקדש בי הכל שכך כל כאב שבי מרפא את הלב
The U.S. and EU have imposed sanctions on Bensi Gubstein, an ally of National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir, and two entities that raise money for Israeli men accused of settler violence. The latest action aimed against those Washington blames for the escalating violence in the West Bank. Reserve Lieutenant Colonel Maurice Hirsch is the director of the Initiative for Palestinian Authority Accountability and Reform in the Jerusalem Center for Public Affairs and the former director of the Military Prosecution for Judea and Samaria. We spoke to him about the latest batch of sanctions and the reports that the U.S. will also sanction the IDF's Netzach Yehuda battalion.
So basically, the sanctions that were imposed by both the Americans and the Europeans is to list a number of persons slash organizations as terrorist, as basically terrorist entities. That then subjects them to all types of sanctions that are applied to those categories of institutions and people that prevent them from banking processes and travel, obviously, and really do give that whole connecting envelope of a terrorist entity that should be sanctioned and then dealt with on a more fundamental basis.
Now, we know one of the people in the latest batch of sanctions was Bensi Gopstein. He's the head of the La Hava organization, which was decreed to be racist earlier this year by the courts. What about the other individuals and the two small right-wing groups that were chosen by, for the sanctions? What do we know about these groups and these people?
So I think the organizations that were targeted by the sanctions are predominantly unknown for the most part. They are people who are, in some cases, have some type of a public figure, but nothing more than that. In some cases, we're talking about the European sanctions, about almost journalists, people who carry out journalistic functions, Meir Ettinger, Elisha Yared, these people who are also sometimes involved in activities which the EU may consider to be violent, but under that whole environment of exposing what is actually going on, obviously these are people who are on, and it's really important to stress, these are people who are on basically the fringe of Israeli society. In many cases, they are people who are not in any way part of the mainstream. They are have their own groups and circles of friends, and really it's something which most Israeli society doesn't even see as an integral part of what's going on.
The US and European spokespeople in the past have claimed that these individuals and organizations were directly linked to, in most cases, violent actions against Palestinians in the West Bank. Is that true?
So the question of the involvement of these people who have been sanctioned both previously and currently in acts of violence is questionable. In some cases, you have people who have been involved in some type of violence but have never been convicted of crimes. Here, basically, what the Europeans and the U.S. administration have relied on are reports and accusations against these people without really ever giving a clear indication of why they are specifically targeting them. Even in cases where you have convictions for certain offenses, that isn't necessarily a basis for imposing the whole sanctions regime. And really, what these sanctions show, both the previous ones and the current one show, is a heavy, heavy bias against Israel and against Israelis. For example, the Palestinian Authority has an entire program to incentivize the murderers of Jews. Everybody knows about it. The world knows about it. The European knows about it. The U.S. administration knows about it. And yet no one on that program, starting with Mahmoud Abbas and downwards, has ever been the subject of any sanctions. Now, one is the case of private individuals who may or may not be involved in illegal activity, and the other is a institutional policy of incentivizing and rewarding murder. And the U.S. administration seems to have completely ignored those people, choosing only to focus on specific individuals in Israeli society who they seek to demonize as part of a wider plan.
These, I believe, are the third round of sanctions imposed by the US and the Europeans on far-right individuals. But there was something new emerging also over the weekend. There was a report on the Axios website, which is usually quite reliable, that the administration is now considering sanctions against the Netzach Yehuda battalion of the IDF. Can you explain to our listeners what this battalion is and why would the US sanctions battalions against an IDF unit?
So this is probably the most outrageous report that we've seen. And if it proves to be true, it's something which would really be a major step forward in U.S. policy against Israel. Netzach Yehuda is one of the fighting battalions in the IDF. It's an integral part of the IDF. It's a unit which is predominantly made up of ultra-Orthodox soldiers who have come into the army, and really it's been the source of not a small amount of focus by the anti-Israel groups, because here you're talking about not only Jews living in Israel, but religious Jews living in Israel, who they seek to demonize on a constant basis. And really what this decision, if it really folds out to be true, it means is that the U.S. administration is saying that the IDF has an organization, has a unit, which has a policy of breaching human rights, and that the IDF is not doing anything about that in order to enforce the law against soldiers who act in a manner which is not in any way, shape, or form part of IDF policy. That has far-reaching consequences, specifically for the International Court of Criminal Court, where Israel claims to have a legal system which effectively enforces the law. And what these U.S. sanctions are really saying is that the U.S. administration doesn't trust Israel's internal law enforcement against soldiers who breach the law. That is something which is a statement against the entire IDF and the entire law enforcement in the IDF. And if it happens, will truly be something very, very disastrous. And really, it would be equivalent to the U.S. administration handing the IDF to the International Criminal Court on a silver platter.
A few of the soldiers in this battalion were convicted of violence against some Palestinian detainees a few months ago, and they were disciplined, I believe.
Yes, indeed. There have indeed been instances in a few army units, in a few IDF units. Unfortunately, the IDF, whilst the circumstances are possibly less, the IDF in some cases is not different from other armies, and as you have misconduct by soldiers in every other army, so you have that occasionally also in the IDF. Those instances are dealt with forcibly by the IDF, whether it be in command chained procedures or even with criminal prosecutions. And that is something which is seen has been assumed to be very effective until now, which is why you don't see very, very wide-scale cases of abuses.
How on earth would this, assuming these sanctions are introduced against this battalion, how on earth would it work in practice? Suppose there's an airlift coming in of 100 APCs and a few thousand rockets. The IDF would have to ensure that equipment doesn't reach this battalion?
Yes, that's what it would require. It would require the IDF to differentiate with all of the equipment that it receives from the U.S. between one of its units and all of the rest, and thereby vilifying them entirely. That means really closing the unit effectively, because obviously a unit like that couldn't continue to function, being completely separate from the rest of the IDF.
Reserve Lieutenant Colonel Maurice Hirsch from the JCPA. And now to the anticipated Rafah offensive. Dr. Eyal Hulata, a former national security advisor in the Bennett-Lapid government and currently a senior international fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, told the Jerusalem Press Club that it seems clear to all at this juncture that Hamas is not interested in a hostage release deal that would allow a path for a ceasefire.
I think the main things to look at is clearly the fact that it seems like Hamas is not really interested in a hostage deal, unfortunately, and that does not allow for a path for a ceasefire that I think everybody is looking for. Almost everybody is looking for. You're all stationed in Israel. I'm sure you're following. I think there's a growing majority of Israelis who understand the need to bring the hostages back before it's too late. The number of live hostages is on the decline by the day, by the week. I think there's a strong sense that we're running out of time on behalf of their on their sake for this. But of course, to have a deal, Hamas needs to agree, Sinwar needs to agree, and unfortunately, he does not feel that time is running out for him for a host of reasons. Part of it is militarily, of course, but I think a huge part of it is diplomatically. When Sinwar looks at what's happening and he sees the amount of pressure on Israel in the international community and the rise of the voices that are calling for ceasefire without a hostage deal, I'm sure that gives him encouragement. And in parallel to that, neither the Qataris nor the Egyptians, which hold the financial lifeline on the one hand and the physical lifeline on the other hand, are not pushing him to come to a deal and reach a ceasefire. So it seems, unfortunately, that Sinwar feels that he has room to maneuver. As long as that will be the case, I think we can't expect a hostage deal. In such a case, the only option that Israel has is to continue to pursue military. There are, I think, no other options. I think the Americans understand that. I believe that the European leaders understand that as well. And what we should expect in this regard to see in the coming weeks is the mobilization of the program to move the civilians from Rafah. It's not only civilians, it's also field hospitals and infrastructure that was built down in the south, moved elsewhere, and the IDF has a plan for that so that they can create conditions that would allow them to operate in Rafah without endangering civilians in an unreasonable way. This will be, I think, the main thing to look at in the following weeks. Of course, to it is attached the importance of diplomatic collaboration with the Egyptians. This cannot happen while the Egyptians do not at least understand or acknowledge the need for that and do things on their part. The Egyptians are worried from day one that Gazans will cross through the border into Sinai and make this their problem, even though it could have been a very important humanitarian relief for the civilians of Gaza if they could temporarily move to Sinai. But President Sisi has refused to do this from day one. There will need to be some kind of coordination with them so that this doesn't damage the fragility of relationship as it is already at the moment. This is what we should look for, I think, in the context of Gaza.
Do you think that now is the time to move forward with such an operation? How do you see that playing out specifically, you know, from where you're sitting in Washington in terms of the support that we might have from our strongest ally in the West?
Yeah. So first, as it comes to Israel, I think what we've seen, as I said at the beginning, I think the analysis in Israel is that we cannot have a hostage deal at the moment. Sinwar won't give it to us. We see, by the way, I haven't talked about this in the beginning of the briefing, and this wasn't asked. I hope this is because you all recognize that Israel is doing way more than it did initially on the humanitarian aid to the Gazans. Those of you who've heard me before, then you know for a fact, I've been saying this from the initial brief. After the war started, I think I said back then, Israel needs to push a lot of humanitarian aid into Gaza. This should not be a bargaining part of the conflict. And I think what you see over the last 2-3 weeks since that very unfortunate, horrific strike on the World Kitchen, World Center Kitchen workers, unfortunately, a very unfortunate incident, you see a lot more. I think Israel should have done that before. But in any case, there is a lot more aid coming into Gaza. So given the fact that there is no hostage deal, and given the fact that there is a lot more humanitarian aid to the Gazans, I think there is an understanding also by the administration that Israel, there is not more that we can do, right? If they agree with our goals, which is to remove Hamas from ruling Gaza, to bring back the hostages, creating new conditions in Gaza, Israel is exhausting its means. And I think we should expect the administration to understand that and to back Israel as we move ahead also towards an operation in Rafah. Of course, the civilians, as I said, will need to be evacuated. And the program for that, I expect us all to start seeing in the motion. Let's see how this plays out. Will that change Sinwar's calculus? Maybe. I don't think so, but it might.
Regarding the Northern Front itself, you posed, you know, a very logical dilemma that there's kind of a chicken and egg scenario in terms of whether the evacuees can return home as long as their homes are being bombed, but then Hezbollah is able to continue bombing when nobody is there. How do we risk a situation in which at the end of the day, many families won't end up returning home at all, and then we really have, you know, kind of this abandoned periphery on our northern border?
Well, that would be very unfortunate if this is the case. Israelis cannot be in exile in their own country. This cannot happen. This is the responsibility of the government, of the IDF, to defend the civilians. This is what we failed to do on October 7, and we have to regain that. And I know that even though on April 13, we have been able to prove what Israel really is when we are prepared in defending our civilians, this has little effect on the feeling of the people of the north, and also, by the way, of the people of the south. They are not going back to their homes either, even though there are not many rockets. I think there are more rockets on the communities in the north than there are rockets in the communities in the south this far along into the war with Gaza. Ultimately, this is the responsibility of the government, to restore the trust of the people in the country so that they can go back to their homes. I happen to think that it was a mistake to evacuate all of the people from the north when they started. My late grandfather lived in the north of Israel during the independence war, and they knew that the women, the children, will retreat from the communities, but the men will stay to fight, because this is what the Israeli ethos was for years. In times of conflict, there were times where our borders or war zones all across in 48 could have been also in 67. It didn't happen because we took the preventive action before the attack. But in 48, I think the decision to evacuate everybody was a mistake. I think that the government should have been more thoughtful in the implication that, of course, there was chaos. Everybody were in trauma. I think the government was very afraid that things will go rouge in the north the way they went in the south. But, you know, in hindsight, everything is easier. In any case, where we are, I think they need to strike a decision. And if we're not, and I don't think we should at the moment go into a full-fledged war with Lebanon, we need to finish what we have in Gaza. And hopefully the international community can start doing something about 1701 that was not respected, I think, for a day since it was approved almost 18 years ago. But we cannot continue this way. We need to create a new balance with Hezbollah to deliver the dilemma to them. I don't think they will fire on civilians in large quantities the way they do now, because they don't want a war just as much as we don't. But we'll need to be brave in this. Is the Israeli government capable of being brave and leading its people? We'll have to see. But I think that's important.
Former National Security Advisor Dr. Eyal Chulata. In the 6 months of war, most of the Gaza Strip, swollen with over a million refugees, is heavily damaged, with large swaths of urban areas destroyed and riddled with vast networks of destroyed Hamas tunnels. Many say it is uninhabitable for the near future, even if or when efforts start to rebuild begin. Sinai is the solution. Joel Roskin, a professor at the Department of Environment, Sustainability and Planning at Bar-Ilan University, has proposed turning northern Sinai into at least a place on Earth that the Gazans could settle, even temporarily, as it is an integral part of the Levant, with ample water sources and extensive infrastructure already laid by the Egyptians. I spoke to Roskin about their prospects of the Sinai solution.
They're going to go into a very long haul of waiting for Gaza to be rebuilt. I mean, the urban areas are shred. The underground is mutilated. The surface is churned and full of explosives and debris. And I mean, in the long run, their aspirations are not Gaza. Their aspirations are to return to Israel, where they were kicked out of after the Egyptian invasion in 1948.
But you're saying right now that the Gaza Strip is too small and too demolished to rehabilitate for the moment, so you have to make some kind of idea to move the people or into an area maybe adjacent to Sinai?
I try to, you know, talk many geography, not politics.
Yes.
Because, I mean, it's clear the Egyptians have no interest. They never had interest in helping or evacuating or treating the Palestinians, and they got their way in 1979, the peace treaty with Israel. They got their official border cutting through Rafah. So they have no political obligation at the moment. But I'm talking about geographical and geological facts. I mean, the contrast between Sinai right across the border to Gaza is wild, is outrageous. I mean, everything is churned, torn, dense, destroyed in Gaza, and you have these expanses right next door in Sinai. Not only that, the Egyptians have invested tremendous resources into developing Sinai for civilian and also for future military aspirations against us. So there's tremendous infrastructure there that's in a way not being used and can be utilized and tomorrow.
So this is empty land. Is there water resources in that area?
Yeah, there's also high groundwater tables near the coast. There's also fossilized groundwater in the Sinai. I mean, in a way, Sinai is the northern antenna of Sinai is the continuation of the Negev, more or less. So, as we can sustain population in the Negev, that can also be done in the Sinai. And of course, now it's so easy to gear up desalination plants along the coast. Mm-hmm. International money. You have a huge coast there, and I mean, we're in a new era now.
I mean, the border between Egypt, Israel, and Sinai, Israel and Egypt, is this artificial line that was created in 1906 by the British, and it became right. The border. So, but as a geologist, the natural border is not there. It's sort of like the same vista, both right. sides, right?
Yeah, we're talking geologically about this micro tectonic plate called Sinai, Sinai-Israel microplate.
Mm-hmm.
Sinai, the Negev, and the mountainous areas of Israel is one geological entity. Yeah.
So the northern Sinai, could that sustain large Palestinian population?
Yeah. I mean, for example, the Saudis right now, east of the Tehran Straits, west of Tubuk, they're developing a 30-kilometer-long city right now. Wow. That's planned to house millions of people. Millions. 30 kilometers long. It's wild. So there's no problem to develop deserts nowadays. I mean, deserts, in a way, are mankind's future because they're the less affected areas on Earth.
So the only real reason is the Egyptian, their opposition to having any sort of Palestinians coming in there because they see the Palestinians as Muslim Brotherhood, Islamic fundamentalists. But what benefit would Egypt get if they opened up that northern part of the Sinai for the Palestinians?
Yeah, look, I'm not an expert on the geopolitical situation of Egypt, but they're in tremendous debt. I think close to like $400 billion of debt.
Mm-hmm.
They have a huge population growth that they can't control. They're dependent on so many types of loans and international support. So if this can generate more international support, that's what I'm hypothesizing, then I think this could be beneficial for Egypt.
Would they gain any better standing in the Arab world?
That's the whole thing. It's not only that's the whole problem. Not only the Egyptians are against this kind of proposal, also the Palestinians are, and I assume most of the Arab world, because in this sort of a demographic change, in a way we're reorganizing the Palestinian problem and trying to solve it, and that's the last aspiration and hope of most of them. They don't want this to be solved.
Could you see this Sinai being a temporary solution?
That's also a possibility.
Mm-hmm. In your talks and with people with this idea, what have people said?
I get a very polar reaction.
Mm-hmm.
I got a lot of reaction. A lot of Israelis and let's say Jewish North Americans were very excited about this. And then I got a lot of hate mail.
Oh, really?
I had hate mail. It was the worst things I've ever seen in my life written to me. Terrible things.
And talking about why? I mean, you're raising a proposal.
by hate.
Yeah, but today, as we see what's going on in the world, I mean, there's no room here for debate. There's no room for talk. You know, there's anti-Semitism in its most lowest grade. And, I mean, they use all the words, you know, genocide, ethnic cleansing, and so on and so forth. But I think we have to push forward proposals. This is a big chance to make a change, because if not, the Gazans will just continue to suffer. I was even thinking of writing an op-ed, okay, keep the Gazans in Gaza, okay, and they'll live in tents for the next 10 years and have zero economy. I mean, maybe that's better.
Professor Joel Ruskin of Bar-Ilan University. An independent panel conducting a review into the severe allegations of terror involvement of UN Palestinian Refugee Agency staff members is set to release its final report. The review process was set up earlier this year after at least 15 countries froze their funding for UNRWA following accusations by Israel that at least 12 organization employees were directly involved in the October 7th atrocities perpetrated by Hamas. Another 30 assisted or facilitated those crimes, and as much as 12% of the organization's staff were affiliated with terror groups. These accusations came against the background of numerous past reports of anti-Semitism and glorification of terrorism among UNRWA staff, particularly within the agency's extensive educational system. In March, the review panel, headed by former French Foreign Minister Catherine Colonna, said in an interim report that UNRWA has in place, quote, a significant number of mechanisms and procedures to ensure compliance, although it had conceded that there are critical areas that still need to be addressed. Well, ahead of the release of the review, the monitoring group UN Watch released its own report claiming that the review group is neither neutral nor independent. UN Watch Executive Director Hillel Nour told the Jerusalem Press Club that far from being independent, the review group is rigged from the outset.
We don't know formally. There was no sunlight put on the process, but we do know that although it was the Secretary General who on February 5th made the announcement, as he said, in consultation with UNRWA Commissioner General, in fact, it was the UNRWA chief himself, Philippe Lazzarini, who had announced a few weeks prior that he was setting up this review. So in news articles that appeared in Associated Press and a video in Associated Press and an interview with Australia's ABC Radio on January 17th, 18th, and 19th, a series of news reports and interviews, Lazzarini had announced about 3 weeks prior that he was setting up the review. He said, I will commission a review into these various issues, and I will try to appoint a third party that is reputable, either a professional consulting group, he said, or some independent entity. So clearly it was the Commissioner General of UNRWA himself who initiated the review and who formed it. So it seems that all the Secretary General did here was announce it and make it in his name. But it seems very clear from what UNRWA itself said that they were the ones who made the selections of the members, because they said they were going to choose the members. And so it seems that they crafted the whole thing themselves.
Okay, so I understand that UN Watch says, you know, argues that after your revelation, the committee they established to investigate this is flawed and tainted to begin with. Why the rush now? I mean, after, regardless of what was the impetus, countries stopped funding. So now UNRWA is kind of defunded. I think there's a few countries that are still funding it, but the general tone is that UNRWA itself is tainted and European countries, the West, are not funding it. Why the rush to publish this report about the International Review Group?
So the question, why did they create this review group? So initially, as I indicated, there was the pressure of our report. I should also mention, very important, January 15th, 2 days before Lazzarini made the announcement, he received a letter from the U.S. Congress, the head of the Foreign Affairs Committee, and others, demanding that Lazzarini appear before the Congress and answer questions about his staff ties with terrorism. And he chose not to appear. And it seems that the review group was meant to be sort of to show that they're doing something. So it seems that the purpose of the review group is to show various stakeholders that UNRWA is doing something about the allegations. But at the same time, we know that it's designed for countries to climb down from the suspension and to reinstate funding. And indeed, we have the quotes themselves. Chris Gunness, who was spokesman for 12 years and left a few years ago, but just came back to UNRWA in a surrogate capacity, in an unofficial capacity. He's been aggressive as a spokesman for UNRWA on social media, on Twitter, as well as on Al Jazeera and other platforms. He said that, and I'm going to give you the exact quote. It's in our report. He told Pass Blue, which is a website that advocates for the UN. He said, quote, "I hope the external report by former French minister, soon to be available, will provide the donors with further cover," I'm quoting, "provide the donors with further cover, if that's what they need, within their own internal constituencies to resume funding for UNRWA." So Chris Gunness, who there's no one more plugged into what UNRWA is thinking and doing, he said expressly that the whole point is to give donors cover for their internal constituencies who are going to say, what are you doing? The whole report is to provide cover. So in other words, the report is not an impartial investigation into how anywhere from 500 to 2,000 UNRWA officials are belong to Hamas or Islamic Jihad in Gaza, not into the fact that our group, for example, has been sending for 10 years warnings to UNRWA that they have thousands of staff, we estimated thousands, who incite terrorism, and their response by Chris Gunness was to attack us. Not that UNRWA is going to impartially investigate why 3,000 teachers were part of a chat group that celebrated the atrocities. So none of those things, but rather it's to provide cover for donors to resume funding for UNRWA to satisfy their, quote, internal constituencies. So he said it himself. And indeed, I quoted before Lazzarini, who said, even as he announced on January 17th, and 2 days afterwards in various interviews given, even as he announced to AP and Australia's ABC Radio that he's going to commission an independent review into allegations about neutrality breaches, that's a euphemism at the UN, as he said, allegations that they have ties with Hamas, let's not use the euphemism. Even then, he said that these allegations constitute, they're disingenuous, they're politically motivated, and they are a smear campaign. So right from the beginning, we know that UNRWA, which created the review, never treated this as a serious investigation into widespread promotion of terrorism, complicity with terrorism. The head of the union for years in Gaza was Su'eil al-Hindi, the head of the UNRWA staff union. He's a member of the Hamas Politburo with Yahya Sinwar. He was elected publicly in 2017 to the Hamas Politburo. He's he's one of the leaders of Hamas. And eventually he was embarrassed UNRWA was embarrassed by the public revelations. So they let him go. They actually asked him to resign so he can still collect his UNRWA pension today. And when he was suspended the first time in 2011, 8,000 UNRWA teachers in Gaza went on strike at Hamas's initiative to rally in his support. They went on strike for 3 months. The UNRWA teachers shut down 243 schools, abandoned 220,000 students, and there were 8,000 teachers rallying for the Hamas Politburo member, Su'eil al-Hindi, to remain the Gaza staff union leader. So to say that it's just a few bad apples, which has been the talking point of UNRWA's apologists, is absurd. 8,000 UNRWA teachers went on strike for 3 months to support the Hamas Politburo member for his right to be the UNRWA staff union, even though he works for Hamas. So all of this is treated as a smear campaign, which is very sad. UNRWA is not taking it seriously. So that is the origin of this review, and that's why we think it's very important to ask the question, who are the members of the review group, and what do we expect to see?
Hillel Noor, Executive Director of the NGO Watch. That's our show for this evening. I'm Aryeh O'Sullivan, wishing you a Shavuot Tov, and we leave you with this song, Tirkod LaNetzach, by Omer Adam and Infected Mushroom. Dance forever.
הראש בעננים תני לי
שתי דקות איתך, ילדה של החיים שתי, אני מאושר תמיד אמרת זה העיקר, והכאב על הפנים שלך אף פעם לא ניכר, בדוק היית גם מתעקשת ואני לב ממתכת, אין מצב שאת הולכת, כן אחרת זה נגמר, עכשיו נשאר לי רק שקט ואין לי אף אחד, הלב שלי צורך כי היא תרקוד לנו